Before you listen to this great episode of Partner with Survivor, we'd just like to tell you about a powerful new practice tool the Safe and Together Institute has launched. Our perpetrator pattern mapping tool has been available for 10 years, but now it's available for the first time in a web-based version. What it does is really help you map perpetrators' patterns of behavior onto child family functioning, talk about its intersections with mental health, substance abuse, and other issues, address intersectionalities, worker safety, all in an easy-to-use online package that protects the confidentiality of your information and lets you wrap it all up in a neat little package, basically, to print it out and to kind of document all those different pieces of information. This is a tool that can be used by both survivors and practitioners. And for the very first time, it's available immediately online without any other prior training.
The training is embedded in this powerful practice tool so that teams that have not been trained in Safe and Together can immediately begin mapping in an effective way.
That's right. It's like having a Safe and Together coach in your back pocket is what I like to say.
There you go.
So we really encourage you to go to our virtual academy, academy.safeandtogetherinstitute.com. Check it out. You know, you can subscribe to it immediately or you can check out a free demo version for 30 days. So please reach out to us and try this new tool. Now enjoy this great episode of Partner with Survivor. And we're back.
Hello. You're, there.
Hi there. How are you?
Person who I see all the time, but I'm always surprised to see on the podcast.
That's right. So, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Partner with a Survivor. It's been a little bit of time, I think, between episodes that we've recorded, especially.
We do have some episodes that we've recorded that are coming in the shoot.
That are coming, like one with Beth Ann Moorhart.
Really excited
about. So you're listening to Partner with a Survivor. I am David Mandel, the CEO of the Safe and Together Institute.
And I am Ruth Raimundo Mandel, and I am the e-learning and communications manager.
And we're here with Tiberius the dog.
Tiberius is here with us this time.
And he's not always here with us. He's between us on the couch, and we are on Tunxus land. In the beautiful Farmington River Valley, you know, the traditional custodians of land of the Tunxus and the Masako people. And we just want to acknowledge that we are on indigenous land and that we are acknowledging elders past, present, and emerging who are listening. So thank you very much. And we are just back from our huge swing through the Asia Pacific region. And we'll be talking about my new book and setting up a series of minisodes about the book. Mm-hmm. But first, we want to talk just briefly about our trip to Australia and New Zealand.
Right. Well, we went and we visited our son in New Zealand, in Wellington.
Yes.
Where he's quite enjoying working and living the Wellington cafe culture.
That's right.
And that was really lovely to be able to be there. You also did some work in Wellington. You met with a lot of government ministers.
And we've got two, you know, we were there, hosted by a couple of our partner agencies, Totoko Mai and Home and Family. And, you know, we set up a series of meetings with Justice and with the Family Violence Minister and Child Protection. And we're really excited about just sort of the uptake of the model in
New Zealand. And
then we took
a little jaunt.
Across the Tasman
Sea.
To Melbourne and did our, what do we do?
We shepherded. We did our Asia Pacific conference.
I think it's our seventh one.
It is our seventh one. It was our first independently. It was our first independent Asia Pacific conference in the Melbourne Convention Center.
It was our first hybrid. Which means people joined us from online.
From
Japan, in person.
From New Zealand, from Singapore.
From parts of Australia. And that's an equity and access issue for us, which is sort of making the conference available and the content available to people, different countries, rural areas, places where they have difficulty traveling.
Well, I got quite a shot in the arm when I saw somebody on LinkedIn say that they were going to be attending the conference with their new wee little baby nursing on their laps.
Right.
And that was really the idea. You know, I know that women form the backbone of the social service industries. and the care industries.
Right.
And that we are doing so many different things at once, that we're caring for other people while we're caring for our families, while we're, you know, really trying to live these connected relational lives of taking care of, you know, our elderly parents or our young children, or we're out in the middle of nowhere where it's very difficult for us to get to a conference in the big city. And I was really, really, really grateful that we could provide that online platform for people to attend from either remote areas of Australia or other parts of the region, but also just so that they could attend in the comfort of their own office or homes in a way that worked for them.
And we got to hear, I mean, the conferences, there's so much we could say about the conferences, you know, whether it's the masterclass on the model that our regional manager, Jackie Ruck, did in terms of context of First Nation people, or the panel we did on the model and its work with First Nation peoples in Australia, and mm-hmm. or history of research with the University of Melbourne, or the implications for the family core. I mean, just so much, and maybe another podcast we'll talk about those things.
Right.
But one of the things that's standing out for me now is actually hearing from folks who listen to the podcast.
Oh, some of them with their kids.
With their kids. You know, they come up to me.
Not to curse anymore on the podcast.
You can curse. I don't think that, but they mostly come up to you, but they come up to me sometimes. Somebody came up to me later in my trip around that. And they say things like, I listen with my kids, usually in the car. Mm-hmm. And my kids ask me questions, or I ask them questions. And, you know, one person said to me, and then my kid goes to school and then comes back and reports on sort of seeing coercive control at school and challenging people.
And disrupting
it. Yeah, and disrupting it. And so anyway, so those of you who are using, we'd love to hear more from people who are listening. We've heard from people who are doing it for professional development, and, you know, the trips are great for hearing feedback. But if you're listening with your kids, please let us know. We're really excited about that.
Because definitely having more relational abuse podcasts that speak to youth populations is a really good way to spread cultures and societies of permission and freedom and consent.
So then we did the conference, and then pretty soon after that, you went home to family.
I did.
I went to do some work on the south coast of New South Wales with First Nation communities as part of a Ministry of Health, New South Wales Ministry of Health research project with the University of Melbourne. And then from there, which was just amazing to work with it, these two organizations, Wominda and Katungal, in Naruma and Nowra in New South Wales, and just really to get to meet some amazing people, talk about the model, its application in community, learn. I learned so much. I listened so much. And then from there, jumped over to Sydney and did work with the Federal Family Court, and had an amazing time doing a half-day workshop for registrars and court child experts together, and hearing from them how much the safety of their institutes work with the court has changed their culture over the last 3 years. And we're really trying to figure out ways to measure that. And we always want to hear about from end users and survivors. And we got a little feedback through the grapevine from folks saying that they're seeing differences, you know, from outside the court, which really means a lot to me.
I feel like really landing ourselves in our collective commitment that we want to see not just families, but services which are supportive of healthy, nourishing relationships, which support families in material ways. And even people, you know, who argue that certain people should have the right to coerce or abuse their family, they relationally yearn for having healthy, connected relationships where they don't lose their children their families to their own abusive behaviors. And so really keeping that in our sight as we work together in these diverse services and sectors, that what we're trying to create is stability and safety and self-determination for families. And we want perpetrators who are parents to be held behaviorally accountable in ways that change their behaviors, because every child wants to have a parent or parents
right.
that are functional
right.
and that are supportive and that are nurturing. We want that connection with our families. We yearn for that connection with our
That's
families
right.
and our cultures. So we're all very committed to making this happen.
And for me, you know, seeing practitioners through, and thematically, I think, through the trip, seeing practitioners, and I want to say this to the survivors that are listening, that no matter what improvements we see, whatever changes we make, that systems are always going to be imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to be imperfect. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that to see the genuine excitement of practitioners across different disciplines, but I'm thinking right now about the folks sitting in a family court, about applying the model. Mm-hmm. And many people, you know, having people come up to me and identify themselves as survivors. And I think that's one of I think a little bit of the secret sauce in the model, to be honest, mm-hmm. is that it really speaks to survivors who are practitioners. And we've heard over and over again saying, I wish I had had this experience. And I'm thinking about actually one person, you know, who was a practitioner in one of the sessions and actually one of the First Nation sessions, who identified as a survivor and who got herself out without any supports, out of an abusive relationship. So again, I think we have to keep acknowledging that there's very little divide between the practitioner community and the survivor community.
Right.
Even if you're not a survivor, you're sitting next to one mm-hmm. in the next cubicle. Let's mm-hmm. really be honest about that. Mm-hmm. And so she and I, we were talking, and she talked about the abuse, but also how she got no help from family or professionals. Right. And I was talking about, you know, how do you, you know, the validating and the partnering and telling somebody that, you know, that we see how hard you're working to keep your kids safe and see, you know, understand your strength. And she said, unsolicited, she said, I felt that in my body when you said that.
Right.
Nobody had said that. Nobody had said that to her until I said that
right.
in that training context where she was showing up as a professional. And so for me, I think one of the bits of the secret sauce of the model is that we are speaking to practitioners who are survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And this resonates with them on multiple levels. It gives them a tool to use as a practitioner, mm-hmm. but it really speaks to their personal experience, either what they did experience and got, or what they didn't get oftentimes, unfortunately, and what knew that would make a difference.
I believe, too, that the model is speaking to people who are really, truly committed to shifting the environment around us to create support.
Right.
To create safety,
right.
to create self-determination, to create the ability of children and women to choose
right.
and self-determine. And so you don't have to be a survivor.
No, you
don't. To want that. You don't have to be a survivor to focus upon that.
And to be excited about it.
Right.
I know. I think so. So anyway, so that's a little, a little bit of a kind of. Yeah. Hey, this is where we've been. We've been traveling. I was on the road for a month.
You were
28 days. Left on March 1st and came back on March 28th.
That was the longest we've been apart since pre-COVID.
Yes.
Wow. And
yes, I did miss you.
I missed you too.
Yeah. So.
All right. So we're going to talk about the book today. So
What book? Wait, what is this? what are we talking about?
David Mandel.
Yes.
You are David Mandel, by the way, just
yes.
in case anyone was doubting. Has written a book, Stop Blaming Mothers and Ignoring Fathers, How to Transform the Way We Keep Children Safe from Domestic Violence. And though it's not a step-by-step or a how-to of the Safe and Together model, it really lays out the realities of current practice, especially the myths which drive people's current practice. It talks about the way that those myths play out in practice to the detriment of domestic violence victims, adult and child domestic violence.
And to practitioners, right.
And to the detriment of perpetrators as parents who actually are capable and do want to change via not assessing or evaluating
right.
them and ignoring them.
Right.
which creates more danger for everybody involved. So I wanted to kind of dive into why you wrote this book, and you did write it in a myth structure, and I'm just going to read the chapter headings before we start, so people kind of get a sense of the overall structure of the book.
And in this episode, we're not going to go through
the myths. Right. We're just going to talk a little bit
introduction
about why the book, what it's intended to do.
Yeah.
And then we'll dive with some mini-sodes into the myths and do a little bit of myth-busting. My kids loved that show when they were growing up, the Mythbusters. So you're like the domestic violence Mythbuster. So in the chapter headings, these are the chapter headings. Just quickly rolling through it. Why does she keep choosing him over her children? Question that we've all heard professionals ask, and society in general. Blaming mothers, ignoring fathers. Challenging professional myths about domestic violence. The myth of the child witness. The myth of the domestic violence incident. The myth of failure to protect. The myth of perpetrator accountability. The myth of parental alienation. The myth of trauma-informed practice. Critical components and principles, a common language. Now this is moving into Safe and Together. Developing evidence for the model. Honoring the voices of survivors and practitioners, and change starts now. So those are the chapter headings of the Stop Blaming Mothers and Ignoring Fathers, How to Transform the Way We Keep Children Safe from Domestic Violence. So why did you want to write this book? Because it's very comprehensive. It's very high level, a look at cross-system, cross-professional practice, and how it all kind of impacts child and adult victims of domestic violence in adverse ways that don't create safety or stability or self-determination. Why did you want to have such a high-level view of things?
Well, you know, you say high-level, and it really is, it spans the nitty-gritty of sort of day-to-day behavior practitioners, you know, to bigger ideas. But it really is, for me, I mentioned this in the book, kind of how people look under the hood of the model. Like you said, it's not a how-to book. It's you know, it's not a replacement for the training. It's not a replacement for the e-learning. Mm-hmm. But it really was meant to span the audiences of survivors, to people new to the model, to experienced practitioners even, like our certified trainers, to say, this is some of the thinking and the problems that the model is actually trying to fix in some ways. It's almost going backwards and saying, okay, let's kind of look at this and say the biggest issue, and I think many people listening to the show or know the model, is saying the underlying issue is this gender double standards, you know, that really, you know, you can create a service here, you can create a new criminal justice response. Everybody's talking about coercive control
as a criminal, criminalization, right?
Or you're talking about sort of a new child protection service or a new, and part of the theory behind the model and the approach in the Institute is we actually need to change the way we think. And then we need to put that to new behaviors, right? And so the idea here is that while both men and women can be violent and controlling, and they're absolutely true. And I've had some people say, no, I'm not ignoring, you know, mothers' abuse of their kids. Absolutely not. Or I'm not ignoring violence in same-sex relationships, or I'm not ignoring, and those are realities that exist. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of ands in the book in some sense, and that if we don't tackle what's true across all these systems, the criminal justice system, the child protection system, the family court system, the mental health system, you know, and others, you know, that we don't stop saying, wait a second, we're holding mothers to a different standard than fathers, and we're really, in many ways, functionally ignoring fathers' roles in families, fathers' influence in families. And part of what I'm hoping, you know, and in the title of the book, I didn't say stop blaming domestic violence survivors and stop ignoring perpetrators.
Right.
That was a very conscious choice to say stop blaming mothers and ignoring fathers, because this is actually in some ways a bigger problem than just domestic violence.
Right. No, I totally hear that you wanted to center on the common themes which cross over between different responses and services, which are victim blaming, which ignore the perpetrator as a parent, and thus cause more danger and harm, ultimately, to everybody, not just the child or the victim, but to everybody who comes into contact with that empowered and enabled perpetrator, an entitled perpetrator.
Right.
You know, I totally see that. You know, I wonder what concretely you wanted to create in cross-system professionals. You know, you may have somebody who reads this who's very unaware of what other services are doing and is assuming that other services are doing the right thing and that these victims are being appropriately supported. What did you want them to be aware of?
What I want them to be aware of is an interlocking set of ideas and the myth structure of the book, and it combines with this concept of gender double standard. So it really is, and the more I talk about this book, and I don't know if people understand this, sort of, you know, whether it's the model itself or whether it's writing this book, it's an ongoing learning process for me. It's not like I'm learning with people. I'm learning as people react to the book. I'm learning as I talk about the book. So every time I talk about the book, something else kind of comes to mind. But as what was intended was really to kind of say that there's this interlocking structure of ideas that are all kind of underpinned or connected through this idea of gender double standards and reinforced. So both the cause and the effect of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll talk about kind of that in a second, sort of how that kind of an example of that. But they reinforce each other.
Right.
And in that way become a seamless but problematic framework for prevention, intervention. And then unless we really challenge these things, we're going to keep making the same mistakes over and over. You can change the law. You can create a new program. You can create a new systems intervention. You can create a new information sharing schema.
Right.
Okay.
But it's going to respond the same way.
The same way.
If it's infused with gender double standard.
That's
in
right.
Social network.
Right.
If you're
sharing more, and we've seen this, by the way, you know, I'll talk about the interlocking myth structure in a second, but we've seen this. You create a high risk team intervention. And I've gotten this feedback from people, which is sort of meant to pull together the police, you know, child protection, maybe domestic violence advocates, maybe men's behavior change, all those folks into one place and help them kind of focus on high risk teams. So again, the idea is to manage risk to adult and child survivors.
Right.
And I've had people come to me and say, we're having these police chaired committees. And at the end of it, when the survivor doesn't do, quote unquote, what they think she should be doing, a referral is then made from that high-risk team to child protection saying the survivor is saying to fail and protect.
Right.
And so here you have something that's ostensibly in the interest of that survivor and that child becoming a potentially punitive and negative experience and a focus on them and their failing to protect. That would be an example of that or interagency integrated service response teams where they're looking for information flowing into one, you know, system. And so if you start thinking about, well, who uses systems?
Right.
Well, it's going to be more women than men. Mm-hmm. Is that information going to be truly strength-based or deficit-based? Well, it's usually going to be deficit-based. And if you've got information sitting in this mental health program that says, or this home, this housing program, or this addiction program, and the information you're going to share back to the system, well, we had this survivor in the program, and she dropped out against medical advice. That may be the information that's shared.
Right. Well, you know, interestingly enough, Grant Wyeth just had an article that came out about the Hobbesian dilemma. And it was asking why we don't.
Did you really just bring up Hobbesian dilemma in our podcast? I love that.
I did.
Okay, that's great.
I was a philosophy major.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
Tickled my funny bone.
Right.
But you know, one of the assertions is that we've fixated on victim survivors,
right?
Because we don't want to intervene with perpetrators because we don't feel that it's financially feasible to do so. We don't have the skills or the will to do so. And that we assume the perpetrators are just violent. Men are just violent. And we don't want to deal with
boys will be boys. Right.
We'd rather focus on the victims and tell them what to do.
That's right. This is why the cause and effect is sort of, these are both cause and effect, because in an example, So what we see is, what we share is this mom stopped going to this program and she left against medical advice. What we don't dig down to behind is that her partner came and coerced her to leave, or he was threatening the pet and home. And so she felt like she had to leave to kind of to save the animal, right? Because we know these things happen. So the information,
or a child doesn't comply with therapy. We don't dig down.
We share the information and in the information sharing process, we have the danger just reinforcing the invisibility of perpetrators as parents, because more information doesn't mean better information. That's the, everybody knows that actually.
Right.
You know, if you pause and say, is more information automatically better?
Right.
No, the simple answer is it may be more just reinforcing of groupthink. Mm-hmm. And sort of these,
right.
So this is
where I have a response when people say we're embedding current best practices into our thinking, and current best practices are victim focused.
Right.
They ignore perpetrators as parents.
Right.
They don't dip down into behavioral accountability strategies, which are non-carceral.
Right.
And they don't view professionals as having an obligation to collectively back up what are good parenting behaviors and assist and assess and evaluate perpetrators as parents. So current best practices, when people use that term, I'm a peak body and I use current best practices. To me, that means nothing.
So the book is meant to, why the title has transform in it, was really to say, and it has this myth structure, is this idea that there's, like I said, these interlocking myths that do exactly what you're saying, kind of make the perpetrator as invisible as parents. So I'll kind of give you... Across the board. And this is, in some sense, I'll argue is nobody's fault. You may have a different opinion about this.
Cranky Survivor had an internal response.
Yes, I know.
She
I know
you're quiet.
You know, but so let me use the myth of the domestic violence incident real briefly. And I'm going to dive into these in future minisodes, like we said earlier, a little more deeply. But I think this gives you a sense of the interlocking nature of this, right? Which is that the myth of domestic violence incident, in some ways, the simple kind of explanation of it is the primacy, the focus in our development of systems and definitions and policies around focus on physical violence, the incident of physical violence, right? And while that's shifting slowly, and advocates and women's sector workers and researchers have been talking about course control for decades, you know, in the policy and in the practice arena, we have not strayed very far ultimately from the primacy of physical violence and the focus on that in a lot of the work we do that's done. And so when you think about that as being the focal point, and then you think about what that means is all the other coercive control behaviors of the perpetrator are often invisible in those efforts or not focused on them. And then you think about the myth of the child witness. And the myth of child witness in simple ways is that kids are impacted by domestic violence by seeing and hearing, right? So again,
that lines up. Not by being rendered homeless.
Not by being rendered homeless. That's right.
That's been rendered disabled.
So again, you have the invisibility of the coercive control.
Right.
And you have invisibility of the wider tactics of the perpetrator.
Right.
And then you start seeing that sort of this whole idea of once these things come into play, homelessness or
disabilities
or educational issues or mental health issues for kids.
Substance misuse.
You start seeing how when low standards for men as parents make that male perpetrator's role in creating those housing issues or those mental health issues invisible, they get decontextualized from the perpetrator's behavior. If the only connection is to the kids see or hear the violence and focus on the incident.
Right. It doesn't matter if he made them homeless.
That's right. Because that's not in our view. And then who's responsible for fixing that?
It doesn't matter if he contributed to their truancy.
So both on the causing the problem, but also who's responsible for fixing the problem with the kids.
Right.
The housing issues. So you end up getting survivors being told, moms being told, well, you haven't been able to maintain safe and stable housing for these kids.
We're going to take
the kids from you. And again, that then moves to the myth of the failure to protect culture, which is we have to do this to keep kids safe from domestic violence.
Right.
And what you'll see throughout the book is it really kind of looks across these myths, some of which are more prominent in different systems, but they're very active across systems. So failure to protect is very active in the child protection system. Yeah. The myth of domestic violence incidents really across different things. The myth of child witness is relevant in different systems. The myth of parental alienation is mm-hmm. very high in the list of problems or challenges in family court that I really try to kind of question this interlocking set of ideas that really causes and also it results in perpetrators as parents, fathers, you know, who are perpetrating, being invisible in practice in the system, which makes it right. impossible to hold them accountable.
Right.
And on the other side, elevates and makes mothers responsible for things caused by that perpetrator.
Right.
And that therefore they're held responsible for causing it and fixing it.
Right.
I think one of the
And then it also ignores right. the realities of other parts of the system, which force contact with an abuser, which, you know, claim that despite their ongoing right. violence,
because now her despite resistance, their ongoing because her resistance violence, now doesn't make any sense.
Right, right.
So really, like it really is about fixing this and helping people see that to, oh, if you leave this perpetrator out all this way, mm-hmm. when you get to this point, then it makes quote unquote sense to blame the mother because, or see her as the alienator because you haven't created the context.
Right.
You haven't put all this. And a lot of what I say now is the trauma-informed practice is wonderful, but the way it's practiced, and I really mean that as a mental health person, it's so powerful. And that's what I mean by the and thing, because I think I don't want anybody to say, oh, David doesn't believe in trauma or trauma-informed practice. That's wrong.
No, it's just not. It's not violence-informed practice.
That's right. It's not enough.
Violence it's not enough. Awareness. Right.
And we have to be able to say, wow, that trauma assessment's been decontextualized from the context of the perpetrator's behavior.
Well, not only that, you know, we've seen proposals within law that are meant to protect children that use ACEs as a measure. ACEs is a backwards understanding of the impact of violence, right. but it doesn't identify who the perpetrator is and their pattern of behavior. Right. Thus, leaving that open to if somebody is falsely accused with no pattern of behavior of being a perpetrator, right. if a victim right. is identified as the perpetrator and a child has high ACEs, thus leading to the removal of that child from that person's custody. It is a...
I
don't want to use... I don't want to curse because children are listening. But it is a cluster F of failure. Yeah,
but it derives, you know, and this is why for me it's so... This is meant to be... This is an effort. I hope, and the feedback I've gotten from the book already has been really positive. It really is a love-driven effort. And I don't think people understand that about me sometimes, which is the clinicians who really drove and the researchers who drove the trauma field and the ACEs field and the people who I watched step in, you know, and you just reminded me of one classic conversation I was part of. Sitting in a room, driven by a bunch of clinicians who wanted to help child welfare become more trauma-informed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely a valuable mission. Great intentions.
Yes.
And so what they said was, we want to do a trauma screening on every family that comes into child welfare. So they're looking through this clinical lens. Mm-hmm. They're looking through this treatment lens. They're looking through this healing lens. I mean, again, really valuable things. But they were doing it out of context.
Not understanding how the system uses
that's
that
right.
information.
And that's right. And so they sort of said, we want to screen these kids, these parents, no, no, no. And if a kid shows up with all these different ACEs, we want to be able to intervene with them. And I stopped them and said, this is lovely. And I turned to a colleague of mine who was a child welfare professional. They were CPS through and through. They're the training director. And I said, if you saw this kid and you saw that they had three ACEs, that they'd been sexually abused, they exposed to domestic violence, and that maybe they had a parent who overdosed from drugs, what would be your response? And without missing a beat, she said, we would take that kid.
Right.
And the clinician was kind of, I don't even know ultimately what they did with that information, but they had, it had never crossed their mind right. that information fed into this other
system this way.
That focuses on these things, on safety, on neglect, right. was going to interpret this information differently.
Right.
And so for me, the book is so much about both honoring, you know, I really talk about how the cycle of violence theory was groundbreaking at the time because it broke apart this sort of pop psychology, misogynistic attitude that women are abused because they liked it, for instance. And it put into context sort of there were behaviors that the perpetrator engaged in,
right,
that created, quote unquote, this cycle. And that this was true for some women, that some experiences some women, but that it was actually another theory, talking about interlocking, and is that it was something that centered the incident of domestic violence. You know, you have the escalating tension period,
right,
and then the quote unquote explosion, which is usually physical violence, and then the honeymoon period. You know, this language, you know, that, you know, so all of that centers one, the domestic violence, right, incident, and doesn't help us focus on coercive control. Doesn't help us see.
It doesn't see the environment that people are living in either. You know, I mean, I'd love to see a cycle of violence chart that includes the system's failure.
Right.
And adversarial responses to victim survivors in the cycle of violence.
I talk about that.
Oh, the victim went to their pastor,
right,
and their pastor told them,
right,
to honor and obey their partner.
Right.
Oh, the victim went to their therapist, and their therapist centered the perpetrator's childhood trauma. Oh, the victim went to child and family services, and child and family services focused on their parenting and not the perpetrator's parenting. Like, you are part of the cycle of violence.
Right, exactly. This is what the book, all the things the book tries to address while saying these things, these ideas, the idea of the importance of focusing on physical violence, or the idea of failure to protect, or the idea of trauma informed, right, practice, really trying to find the things that are important about those things. The failure to protect thinking is in your best interpretation is designed to keep kids safe, but it focuses on what the sin of quote unquote omission that the survivor parent doesn't do versus the perpetrating parent's responsibility,
right,
as a parent.
Right.
So I try to really be, on one level, really be balanced. But the other hand, sort of say, look, if we don't tackle this stuff, we're going to be caught in a web of practices and ideas that moves us out of alignment with the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because that honeymoon period doesn't exist for
it's
this survivor.
Coercion.
It's coercion still. Yeah, no,
it's called, I'm not being abused right now. I'm going to be very, very quiet and compliant.
Right.
And do the best that I can.
Right. And I accept the flowers, because if I say, throw the flowers down on the ground and say, no, get out of here with your flowers, I'll get abused again.
Right.
You know, but
and then somebody's going to say, why didn't you just accept the flowers?
Right. Right. Isn't it lucky? You know, you're lucky to have a man.
But, who gives you flowers?
And then I think to kind of land this sort of intro to the book, and for practitioners, that when these ideas, and help you understand how these ideas do not serve you as the practitioner.
Right, right.
Not only are they out of alignment with the lived experience of survivors, but they don't serve you.
Well, they're out of alignment with your stated goals.
Your goals and your values.
And, you know, if you really want to keep kids safe, it's not policing and punishing the,
right,
victim that's going to do that.
Right.
It's all of us collectively, right, focusing on the pattern of behaviors of that person,
right,
who is a perpetrator and who's harming their family.
Right. Right.
And you know, basic behavioral modification. All of us feel somehow, and this is one of the things that I felt was your innovation, where you said child protection is a collective responsibility.
Right.
It's not just the responsibility of child protection. Child protection is a collective responsibility.
Right.
Guess what? Perpetrator accountability is a collective responsibility.
That's right. And
you may not be a perpetrator intervention service,
right,
but you as a professional can certainly look,
right,
at a perpetrator who's a parent and say, this, and this pattern of behaviors is trauma-inducing, is destructive to your relationships, destroys trust,
right,
creates disabilities, physical harm. And if you keep doing it, you are responsible for the consequences to your family and to your family's destruction.
So the book is meant to give you language for that. And what I would say is even more than that. It's meant to dismantle the thinking and change even the way we talk to survivors. So to kind of give you this last kind of image, about gender double standards is I think about the domestic violence perpetrator, you know, who breaks a glass coffee table in mm-hmm. the in the process of an incident of violence. So again, mm-hmm. so we have this incident of violence. The kids are asleep, and we've got a toddler, you know, 3-year-old, you know, sleeping, and the perpetrator engages whatever it is, throws a dish, throws something heavy through it, is yelling and screaming, and then leaves. Okay, so one is that they are acting in a parental role in that moment, which means they're creating
a disruptive, violent environment.
An environment that's just, even if the kids didn't wake up, that is more dangerous because there's broken glass in them. That's why I'm trying to get people past even the incident of violence. Mm-hmm. I think people focus on the kids or hear it or see it. And what I want to say is, yeah, obviously that's a problem if they did. But we also have that ability to say, so if I break the coffee table as that guy and then I leave, I've created an unsafe environment for my kids to walk in their own living room,
right,
or their own house.
And now okay? my co-parent is responsible for picking up
that's
the mess.
Right. That's right. And I think that's, to me, the heart of this imagery that I want people to live with is, mm-hmm. is how do we hold that person accountable who is a parent who created an unsafe environment for those kids, whether right. they're physically there or not, whether the kids saw the violence or not. But the ripple effect is there is glass on the floor. And if it's left unattended to, that kid's going to cut their feet. Mm-hmm. And so I've created, as that parent, a less safe environment than the house was before I acted
right.
that way.
Right.
And then if the person, and we know this is true, the person who's going to sweep it up in 99.9% of the cases is going to be that victim parent, usually the mother.
Right.
How do we hold that person accountable for the harm they created and give credit
to the person who's picking up the mess. Right.
Whether that mess is the glass on the floor, whether that's getting the kid to therapy,
right.
where that's putting
getting the kid to school after being abused,
all those things.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to settle and fix with this book and the work and ultimately the model and the training and the e-learning and all this stuff. Okay.
So this is the big picture of the book.
This is the big picture of the book.
The framing of the book. Okay. So next time,
and you can buy it online.
And you can buy it
on Amazon.
On Amazon.
And we're going to have the QR code or the link on the notes.
We will.
But if you're listening and you're like, oh, I want this, go to Amazon in your region and put in the name of the book. You know,
Stop Blaming Mothers and Ignoring Fathers by David Mandel.
Yeah.
And so in subsequent podcasts, we'll start going over each of the chapters and myths and talking about them in a more in-depth way. That you know, helps people to understand that particular myth, how it impacts not just professionals, but also victim survivors, adult and child. But just remember, we're living in this ecosystem of experience. Your services do not exist in a vacuum. You may be doing great practice.
Right.
But what are the people you're referring to doing?
Right.
What are the people that your community partners are doing? What are your, you know, what are they doing?
Right.
Really pay attention to your ecosystem.
This doesn't help you just understand your practice, but it may help you decode what's going on in other systems.
Do you really want to refer this family
right.
to this service if they haven't addressed their gender biased, victim blaming, gender double standards? Are you putting that victim survivor in danger by referring them out to services which don't have some type of self-reflective process about how they're dealing with perpetrators as parents or not? So I really want to challenge you to see yourself as part of an ecosystem. You are not isolated services. You shouldn't be doing this in a vacuum. Right. That's exhausting.
Right.
This is exhausting. Family violence, child abuse is exhausting because it is so prevalent. So we all have to work together to make sure we're pivoting to the perpetrator as a parent, and we're partnering with survivors, and we're understanding their dangers and realities by getting that information from those families and talking to them about their experiences and their challenges.
Okay.
All right.
So thank you for listening to this episode of Partner with a Survivor. And I'm David Mandel, the CEO of the Safer Together Institute.
I'm still Ruth Raymond Mandel, last time I checked.
And if you want to listen to more episodes or find out more about the Safety of the Institute, please go to safetyoftheinstitute.com. If you want to check out our e-learning,
Go to academy.safeandtogetherinstitute.com
and follow us on all the social medias and share this episode and check out the book on amazon.com.
There we go. There. And we're out.